We continue this morning our summer study in the book of Psalms, and after a brief journey deeper into the Psalter, we return to the beginning of the Psalms, having looked at the first book and the first song in the book, Psalm 1. I now want to direct our attention to Psalm number 2. A psalm that is well known, undoubtedly, not only because of its position in the Psalter, but also because of the content of Psalm 2, used over and over again throughout the New Testament, from the Gospels all the way to Revelation. So let's begin by reading Psalm number 2. Why do the nations rage, and the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, "Let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us." He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision. Then he shall speak to them in his wrath and distress them in his deep displeasure. Yet I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, "You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore be wise, O kings. Be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all those who put their trust in him." Travels into several remote nations of the world in four parts by Lemuel Gulliver, first a surgeon and then a captain of several ships, better known as Gulliver's Travels. Written in 1726, amended in 1735, Wikipedia. It's a novel by an Irish writer and clergyman, Jonathan Swift. It's a satirical work. That's a criticism of human nature, and it's a parody of so many travel logs written before it. It is by far his best known full-length work, a classic of English literature, read by most high school students in their British literature class. It has never gone out of print. In the work, Swift famously describes Gulliver's encounter in a nation called Lilliput. The people are Lilliputians, and they have a leader. An emperor, they call him. He is emperor, at least for one reason, because he is taller than all the other Lilliputians by the breadth of a fingernail, which alone, Gulliver tells us, was enough to strike awe into beholders. His description goes on like this of the emperor. His features are strong and masculine, with an Austrian lip and arched nose, his complexion olive, his countenance erect, his body and limbs well proportioned, all his motions graceful, and his deportment majestic. He was then past his prime, being 28 years and 3/4 old, of which he had reigned about 7 in great felicity and generally victorious. For the better convenience of beholding him, I lay on my side so that my face was parallel to his. And he stood but 3 yards off. However, I have had him since many times in my hand, and therefore cannot be deceived in the description. His dress was very plain and simple, and the fashion of it being the Asiatic and the European. But he had on his head a light helmet of gold adorned with jewels and a plume on the crest. He held his sword drawn in his hand to defend himself. If I should happen to break loose, it was almost 3 inches long. The hilt and scabbard were gold and rich with diamonds. His voice was shrill, but very clear and articulate, and I could distinctly hear it when I stood up. The ladies and courtiers were all most magnificently clad, so that the spot they stood upon seemed to resemble a great petticoat spread upon the ground, embroidered with figures of gold and silver. His Imperial Majesty spoke often to me, and I returned answers, but neither of us could understand a syllable. Oh, this great Lilliputian emperor. Only a few inches tall, able to sit in Gulliver's hands. The Lilliputians humorously attempt to tie him down, and the king himself, all quite easily smashable. Lilliputians remind me of Psalm 2. Psalm 2 is a depiction of an attempted assassination of God and his Messiah. And we are like Lilliputians when we attempt to assert our own independence from God. And all the while, we remain oblivious to the power right before us being so mercifully restrained. The world around us has no idea who is in charge as kings and leaders and rulers and peoples in great tumult all throughout history grapple and strain for supremacy. But only one reigns supreme. Only one is ultimate. Only one is the true power in the universe, regardless of what the headlines read. Psalm 2, traditionally labeled a royal psalm by a scholar named Hermann Gunkel, an unfortunate name. Its context is traditionally said to be about the use on the day of coronation. On Mount Zion, as the new Davidic king was installed on the throne, that this song would be recited and sung as part of the celebration attending the ascension to the throne. Well, it doesn't seem like a very celebratory song, does it? It seems to be quite dark, quite foreboding. Why, in the context of a coronation, would a song sing like this? But when you think about the changing of the guard, when you think about a new ruler coming in and the relative instability that can exist during transitions as vassal kings and subordinate rulers have to decide what their power play will be as this new king goes into the throne, Psalm 2 walks us through reality and shows us who is really on the throne of this universe. It's a psalm of sovereignty. And it shows us in 4 acts, if we look at it like a play, 4 acts of the attempted assassination of God and his Messiah. Act 1 is the sovereign's small s and the sovereign capital S. Act 2, the scorn of the sovereign. Act 3, the son of the sovereign. And Act 4, the salvation in the son. The psalm is divided quite naturally in its original poetic form of 4 couplets or 4 sections of 3 verses. And we'll look at each one. Let's start with Act 1, verses 1 through 3, the sovereigns and the sovereign. The psalm starts with a question, right? Why? And it's a question that applies to the whole of verses 1 and 2. It's a why that occurs once, but really is repeated throughout the entire beginning of this psalm, asking us repetitively these questions. Why are the nations in an uproar? Why are people devising a vain thing? Why do kings of the earth take their stand? Why do rulers take counsel together? Why would they against Yahweh and against His anointed one? This is not a question of anxiety. This is not a question of fear. It's an expression of absolute astonishment. The speaker of these first two verses is incredulous. He's saying, "How can they be so stupid? How can they be so profoundly absurd? Why do the nations rage and the people's plot conspire?" The word plot is too weak. It's a word like conspire. It's the same word you saw in Psalm 1, verse 2, as the godly man meditates on the law day and night. He turns it over in his mind. He speaks of it in a barely audible tone, used negatively as it is in Psalm 2. You could use the word mutter. The people are muttering against the king, and all of it is empty in vain. Verse 1. There's no semblance of sanity, the outcome of all their plans and schemes. They all plot in vain. Why, the psalmist asks, why? Even their most violent plans, their most mutinous devices, only will result in their destruction and emptiness. Look at the nouns, nations, peoples, kings, rulers, all people in possession of a measure of authority, some great, some lesser. But look at the verbs. What are these people about? They rage, they plot, they take counsel together, conspiring. All of it is a ridiculous attempt at autonomy. These kings look at the ascension to the Davidic throne and they think now is the time to make our move. Now we can unite our powers to overthrow this ruler. But who is the ruler that Psalm 2 speaks of? The end of verse 2 tells us who these kings and rulers are conspiring and counseling against, who they're muttering against. It's against Yahweh himself, against Yahweh himself, against his anointed, his Messiah. And it's their opportunity for revolt. It's the kings against the king. Nations, peoples, kings, rulers, reviewing their position, calculating the odds, secret plotting, meditating their rebellion, muttering against his rulership. They set themselves. What's that mean? It means that they are making preparations for war. And they have one aim, verse 3, to rid themselves of their oppressors. Let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. Fetters and cords, fancy Bible words. What is it? It's like a leash. It's leather straps that were used to tie a domesticated beast of burden to his yoke. And that's the way they see their relationship with Yahweh. And they want to throw it off. They want to get rid of it. The bonds and cords are a leash, a symbol of utter subjugation. This is their declaration of independence. And it's not about political power. It is against God himself, against Yahweh, to overthrow his authority. No one will tell them what to do. No one will appoint their chosen one, their anointed one over them. They will reject his Messiah, his chosen king. But what they don't understand is that any attempt to overthrow this ultimate ruler will be ultimately futile. This is a reminder to every single one of us, particularly those of you who love your autonomy. And I think there's something in every single one of our natures that loves autonomy, that loves independence. You remember when you were little, You didn't want it. You wanted to seek protection around your mama. You didn't want to go out there because mama kept you safe. Stay close to mama, right? But as you grew older, you began to venture a little further out off the front porch, out into the yard. The danger of stranger began to become a little more alluring. You met people. You went to school. You explored and you started to think, someday I will live somewhere else. And as you wrapped your mind around that concept as a child, you thought, because everyone asks every kid on the planet this question, what do you want to be when you grow up? And you thought, what do I want to be when I grow up? I want to be an astronaut, of course, and an artist. Kids want to be astronauts and artists and zookeepers and veterinarians. And sometimes all combined into one awesome moon animal healing job. And so you began to think about the future, and you began to think about freedom, and you began to think about going to school and getting outside of that protection that you had once counted so valuable. And then you thought of career, and then you thought about your own family. And then in high school, as the great change happened, you began to come into your own and long for those days of freedom, manifest particularly by your ability to navigate an automobile. May I please have the keys? Please. And then once your freedom was purchased by aforementioned keys, you found the roads and the highways and the byways, and your 18-year-old self planned a road trip with your 18-year-old friends, and you said, someday we will go to here. And you slid Google Maps as far as it would slide. And you planned your road trip through the Deep South to explore the intricacies of harmonica music with your friends. A planned trip that never occurred because you fell in love. This is the part we're at right now. But I wonder if you still long for autonomy. I wonder if it still is freedom. You want to do what you want to do. You don't want anyone to tell you what to do. This is our nature as human beings. We don't want anyone to reign over us. We want to be free of all authority. That's why children defy their parents. That's why students disobey their teachers. That's why wives do not submit to their husbands. And that's why men do exactly what they want to do, and they leave their career because their boss doesn't have any clue what he's talking about. That spirit of rebellion is in you. It's a spirit of autonomy. And it's universally idolatrous. It's what happened at the Tower of Babel, right? We will unite. We will build. And we will overcome God's boundaries. Sin is so irrational. And as these nations conspire and these people plot, the very thing the human race will attempt to do just prior to Christ's second coming is shown to us on this scale, and we must show it to our own hearts that long for autonomy and long to be outside of the structures that God has built for us. Because you understand, when you rebel against your parents' authority, you ultimately rebel not against mom and dad, but against God himself. And when you rebel against governmental authority in your life, the rules that are in your society, you rebel not against your society like Che of old, a cool revolutionary dude. Instead, you rebel against God himself, who put the rulers in their place. Does that chafe you? Is a college student tasting as much freedom as possible? Does that chafe you? If it does, it's the idolatry of autonomy. Chuck Spurgeon, famous Christian dead guy, said it like this: to a graceless neck, the yoke of Christ is intolerable, but to the saved sinner, it is easy and light. We may judge ourselves by this: do we love that yoke, or do we wish to cast it from us? Your rebellion doesn't stop with the human authority in your life. That rebellion is symptomatic of rebellion against God. Autonomy is not what you were created for. You were created for submission, submission to the sovereign. And there you find true freedom and joy. And that's Act One: the little sovereigns and the sovereign and their vain attempt at autonomy. Is God nervous? Is God upset? Is God, who longs to show his love to people, is he scared of all the tumult going on? Is he see all these fists clenched and teeth gritting against him? And is God afraid? God quakes. God shakes. But in Act Two, he doesn't quake in fear. He quakes in laughter. Look at verse 4. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. God's response to this rebellion: he sees that it's futile. He sees that it's misguided. He sees that it's ultimately laughable. And we begin to develop, at its very embryonic stage, a theology of laughter. Some of you have your ties on really tight today, and you wonder, why isn't he wearing a coat? And there's too much funny up there. God laughs. Proof text. But wait, there's more. Proverbs 17:22, a joyful heart is good medicine, but a crushed spirit dries up the bones. If you have no joy, if you have no laughter in your life, how them dry bones? There's a man in the Bible named Laughter. His mom, Sarah, laughed and gave him that name with great irony. Psalm 126, verse 2 speaks of mouths filled with laughter and tongue with shouts of joy. Why? Because the Lord has done great things for them. Job speaks of the laughter that he longs for, that he had lost. Solomon, the wisest man to ever live, said there is a time to laugh. The psalmist commands you in Psalm 32, be glad in the Lord and rejoice, O righteous, and shout for joy, all you upright in heart. Proverbs 15:13, a glad heart makes a cheerful face, but by sorrow the heart of the spirit is crushed. Proverbs 14:13, even in laughter the heart may ache. And here's where we see the sober-minded side of humor, and the end of joy may be grief. Psalm 4, verse 7, you put more joy in my heart than they have when their grain and wine abound. Those who know God understand laughter and joy. But this laugh, the laugh of Psalm 2, is not a silly chuckle. It is not a moment of lighthearted humor. Most often in the Bible, when God himself laughs, it is a particular kind of laugh, and it's the laugh that we see manifest here in Psalm 2. It is a laugh of ridicule. It is a laugh of derision, of contempt. And so Act 2 is the scorn of the sovereign. It's a laugh of scorn. Psalm 59, he does one, but you, O Lord, shall laugh at them. You shall have all the nations in derision. Psalm 37:13, the Lord laughs at him, for he sees that his day is coming. It's a confident response from the true sovereign. The scorn of the sovereign is this: he sits in heaven, undisturbed by all the fray. You may be scared of the newspaper headlines. You may fear Iran. Terrorists with all kinds of stuff strapped to them. You may be full of fear when you glance at the headlines, but God sits in heaven and he laughs. Not a laugh of pleasure. God himself, Yahweh, holds them in derision. He sees them as they are, just a hair, just a fingernail taller than the rest. And they would dare to attempt to defy God's authority. He's the one seated enthroned in heaven. He knows he's not the only king. And that's why he has confident laughter in his absolute sovereignty. No dictator's nuclear armament scares him. No one's assertion of their powerful and potent free will threatens him. Everything God does is perfect, righteous, and good. And when he laughs like this, it is righteous laughter. Perhaps this is difficult for you because you had this idol in your mind of a God who isn't like that. Let it be shattered by the truth. When people act like they are something, God laughs. It's as if I were to bring my two daughters up here, Adeline and Ella. I'm not going to. They're going to sit there politely, obeying their mom for now. And if we were to wrestle, do we wrestle sometimes? Yeah. And what do I like to do? Tickle. And they come at me with all their force. And they come attacking on every side, and now the Dukester has learned to crawl, and he comes too. It's a trinity of dangerous children, and they come from three angles at once. And my children wrestle with me, and I say, do your worst. Ha 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 ha! I'll throw the dog in the mix sometimes. Bring it. Bring it, bring it, bring it, bring it. I am not threatened by their most aggressive behavior. I will tickle them and I will hit the dog. PETA. It's a futile challenge. And it's a joy for me. And I laugh because there's not the slightest threat. And God laughs with a disdainful mockery that's so aware of how ludicrous the arrogant ignorance of the impotent are. It's a rebellion that to him is comical. But look what happens to his laughter. It doesn't just keep going. God is not a chucklehead. Look at verse 4. He sits in the heavens and he laughs. The Lord scoffs at them and his laughter begins to turn to anger. Verse 5. Then he will speak to them in anger. In his wrath, he speaks to them. He terrifies them with his authority. Why? Because he declares an event. Verse 6. But as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. The Hebrew in verse 6 is emphatic. As for me, I have set my king. It is I, it says. It is I who have set my king. Like they set their plans against me, I, God, have set my king on my hill. This enthronement takes place with his king on his mountain. He is the one who is installing his king, and it is the reason he is confident and his enemies are in dread. It is the reason for his supreme confidence. There's not the hint of fear or anxiety or nervousness with Yahweh. There's wonderful security and absolute sovereignty. I find no security, none whatsoever, in the conception of a God who is dualistic, at war with the devil. I find no security in a conception of the universe where men are ultimately sovereign, exerting their own free will over the plans and purposes of a sovereign God. I find no comfort in that, and I was raised on that garbage. I was raised on that kind of theology that puts man on the throne of his own destiny. But when you come to realize the absolute sovereignty of God, you share in the confidence that he has over this world, knowing that all he does is righteous and good. And we find comfort and peace there. That's what Edwards called sweet sovereignty. And you find it all over the pages of the Bible. So act one is the sovereigns and the sovereign. Act two is the scorn of the sovereign. And act three is the son of the sovereign. Verse 7. I will surely tell of the decree of Yahweh. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me. I will surely give the nations as your inheritance and the very ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware. There's a guarantee here in God's mind, a guarantee of his absolute assurance that in the end he wins. And it's a merciful warning to every single one of you who seek to live in defiance to God. It's a summons to humble yourself before the sovereign son. This divine decree that he exerts himself over heaven, over Mount Zion, to the very day of the king's enthronement. Now in Act 3, Yahweh himself speaks. And he says, I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. Yahweh said to me, in these verses, there's three features of his decree. He says that his rule is legitimate, his rule is exhaustive, and his rule is forceful. Do you see it? It's legitimate because he says, you are my son, I have begotten you. The anointed one was not someone who had earned his way there. He had deserved it. He belonged there. His rule is exhaustive. Ask of me, I'll make the nations your inheritance to the end of the earth. His rule is forceful. Break with a rod of iron. The scepter of the king becomes a weapon, like a, whatever they call those things you hit people with in war. Mace. You play video games. The scepter becomes a mace, right? And God says he will pulverize them. The point is that this iron is intrinsically strong and pottery is intrinsically weak. God has guaranteed his victory because he has chosen his Messiah, his anointed one. And the Messiah will forcibly enforce his reign on a rebellious people. That is a wonderful place to build your worldview. Three times in the book of Revelation, verse 9 is quoted. Of the Lord coming with something iron and breaking pottery, demonstrating his rule. Jesus is this appointed king. He will establish his kingdom. Is it certain? Absolutely. It's a decree of Yahweh, verse 7. We know where history is headed. At the end of the day, we know how we'll get through. The ultimate power of the universe is God Himself and the Messiah to whom He has promised the whole world. Well, how would you pen the final act? I think it's surprising. Act 4 is the salvation in the Son. It's a summons from God Himself as He urges these kings in verse 10. Now therefore, O kings, show discernment. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Worship the Lord with reverence and rejoice with trembling. It's a summons. Most commentators call it an invitation. O kings, be wise, be warned, take heed, consider the implications, the futility of defying my authority. He urges them to serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. What a strange combination, but a very biblical one. Joy and fear. Dropping all presumption of our small sovereignty and submitting to God in fear and receiving joy promised. Maybe you grew up in a church that had an altar call every week. Maybe they called it an invitation. This doesn't sound like an invitation to me. This sounds like, an invitation. We got an invitation to go to a birthday party for a 5-year-old, and it was awesome. Candyland City. And it was pink and had candy on it. And it was an invitation. This is not pink. This is not an invitation. This is a summons. This sounds more like an ultimatum to me than an invitation. But either way, grace breaks through in this final line as the psalmist begins to preach Christ in the Old Testament. And he says, verse 12, kiss the Son. Why? That he not become angry and you perish in the way. Why should you kiss the Son? To avoid wrath. Why should you kiss the Son? Because it's quickly kindled. His wrath could flare up in a moment. Why should you kiss the Son? To experience joy. Blessed are all who take refuge in Him. Yahweh Himself calls you to serve, to surrender. And that's exactly what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ. And that's why He uses this expression so appropriate in the ancient world in kingship of kissing the Son. When a king was subjugated to another conquering king, he would come and kiss the king's feet. It was a sign of submission, and worshiping and following Jesus Christ is no different now. Take off that tiny little puny Lilliputian crown on your head and throw it down. Put down your weapons of rebellion against God and the authority He's placed in your life and totally surrender to Christ as God's King. Or don't come at all. Because you're not a Christian unless you have submitted to His sovereignty, unless you have repented, and that's real belief. And so He ends with this glorious line, blessed are all who take refuge in Him. An incredible summons of mercy to these swaggering sovereigns who are not sovereign at all. Kiss the Son. Who? God's Son. God's King. His anointed, the Messiah. David, a little bit. Solomon, yes, sort of. The line of Davidic kings in Judah. Only for a little while. Listen to what the apostle said in Acts 13. When they had carried Jesus, and they had carried out all that was written of Him, of Jesus, they took Him down from the tree and laid Him in a tomb. But God raised Him from the dead. And for many days He appeared to those who had come up with Him from Galilee to Jerusalem, who are now His witnesses to the people. And we bring you the good news that what God promised to the fathers, this He had fulfilled to us, their children, by raising Jesus, as also it is written in the second Psalm, you are my Son, today I have begotten you. This psalm was useful to apostolic preaching because the apostles saw the prediction of Christ and the promise of homage to the Son as being the promise of God's merciful salvation. He will break the nations with a rod of iron. He will usher in a new kingdom. But if you are defiant, if you think you're big, if you want things your own way, if you compare yourself to others, Psalm 2 is for you, and it urgently calls you to humble yourself, to remain in your defiance is with great consequence. Everything, friends, everything turns on your submission to Christ as God's chosen King, as God's Son. And so he says, kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. Father, thank you for the refuge that we find in Christ and Christ alone. To hear your sovereignty and your severity is sobering to us. So, Father, bring hearts to ultimate submission to your will, to your sovereignty. May we trust you completely with the entirety of our being, with our whole lives. Father, knowing that your kingship is an eternal one, that to be a subject to you is to be truly and genuinely blessed. Father, thank you for these crossroaders, God. And I ask that you would make this truth very real in their lives as they live in submission to Jesus Christ. Bless us as we go on our way, O God, our King and our Sovereign. In Jesus' name, amen.